in fellowship and continue on here, wrapping up these verses, verses 4 through 6. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I'm surprised he didn't say for myself. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. All right, we stopped here with point 35. Koheleth continued his major building projects, that should be, which are closely linked, with the two preceding projects of gardens and parks. 36, although irrigating a park with sufficient water was a practical matter, as per Isaiah 130, that was worthy of a king, Koheleth reiterates that he did it for himself and not for others. He's not in this, as we might say, for anybody but himself. It's all about him. And the reality is, of course, that this yields the dissatisfaction that he has. At a certain level, as a believer in Jesus Christ, and certainly he was a believer in Messiah. I mean, he wouldn't have known who Jesus was, as it were, but he was a believer. It becomes pretty evident that you are here to serve. You're not here to take. Again, there are two types of people in this world, the givers and the takers. And you want to be a giver. Trust me, in the long run, it is more blessed to give than to receive for a lot of reasons. There's a matter of grace, and you've got to be able to receive as well. I understand that. But the fact is, at this point in his life, he's a taker. He's not a giver. And this really brings dissatisfaction into the life. Isaiah 130, for you will be like an oak whose leaf fades away, or as a garden that has no water. Well, obviously, a garden without water is not going to last very long. So 37, in Palestine, where the rainfall of the winter has to be stored for the dry months of summer, reservoirs or cisterns are of great importance. 38, several are mentioned in the Old Testament, including an important one near Jerusalem, one in Heshbon and one in Hebron. I wonder what book New is. That ought to be interesting. New. Let's see. Maybe. Couldn't be Numbers. Nehemiah, probably. Yeah. Okay. Give me a minute. I'll figure it out. We're working on a mystery here. The mystery of the new book of the Bible. Nehemiah 2:14. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool. But there was no place for my mount to pass. And that's the only place that's actually mentioned, is the king's pool. And may very well have been constructed by Solomon. I mean, we don't really know. Song of Solomon 7:4 also mentions one. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. Your eyes like the pools in Heshbon, by the gate of Bath Ravim. Your nose is like I don't know about this Tower of Lebanon thing, but is this supposed to be a compliment? You got a great giant honker there. So the idea here is, the pools in Heshbon, those are cisterns there. And 2 Samuel 4:12 also. Those actually were compliments, by the way. It was not. He was trying to sweet talk her. 2 Samuel 4:12. Then David commanded the young men, and they hung them, and they killed them, and cut off their hands and feet, and hung them up beside the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the grave of Abner in Hebron. So 39, in fact, three such reservoirs west of Bethlehem may be seen today that are attributed, by the way, by tradition to Solomon. So some of his works may actually have survived even to this very day. 40, it would appear that Solomon was building his own world within a world of beauty and productivity, harmonious and producing pleasure for the one living in it. So how come he's not happy? I mean, if you could concoct your own world, how would you build it? What would you have in it? If money and time were no object, where would you live? How would your house look? What all would you surround yourself with? And Solomon surrounded himself with the best things, the most aesthetically pleasing. I have no doubt that, again, the craftsmen that he had were of the highest caliber. And everything is just great. It's just the way he wants it. Again, better homes and gardens, southern living, these people have nothing on Solomon. His world would have been absolutely one that anybody that looked at it would have said on the surface, I think. If you looked at it, you would say, God, this is great. And yet, it doesn't produce happiness, not long-term contentment. So, 41, in that regard, the use of the word that is translated in the English by paradise. I might even suggest that Solomon had constructed his own personal Garden of Eden. With no forbidden fruits. Nothing was off limits to him either, by the way. Being the king, there was no one who had greater authority. There was no one who outranked him. He was the ranking authority in his day. And so there was nothing he had to deny himself at that level. And so, again, if you had all this, to me, this just it's just incredible the stuff he does. And if you had all this, most people say, God, I would be happy. If I had all that. I mean, if I could make it just the way I wanted it. I mean, it's no longer a work in progress. It is finished and it is perfect and it is paradise. Would you be happy? And the idea is people are still looking for paradise today. They think it's around the next corner. They think it's at the next shopping mall. They think it's on the... I saw today, if this isn't bad enough, you talk about a materialistic society. Now they have fixed it. The Dish Network started it, I believe, and they're going to sell it to the cable companies. You can now go to the Home Shopping Network and buy it with your remote control. You don't have to leave the house. You don't have to shop. You click, click, click. How many bankruptcies is this going to cause, I wonder? You don't have to stop and think about it. You see that thing, it hits your lust grid, bam, click, it's mine. Your order will be delivered in 7 to 10 days, it says on the screen. And I'm thinking to myself, good God, how pathetic. But hey, will this make people happy? Nope. So now you don't even have to shop. You know, there's no online shopping. There's no nothing. There's no middleman. Just click it with your remote and you can buy it. And so we'll see how that all works out for the cosmos. But and you think, okay, well, now then people will be happy. Now they can get it quicker. No. No, it's not going to make them happy. So you can surround yourself with whatever you want. Fix it just the way you want it. Just get it so-so. And then how much time are you going to have to spend taking care of it? Well, Solomon didn't have to spend one freaking moment taking care of it. He just put it on the slaves. The slaves will take care of it. You just keep it looking nice, and it better look nice when I come out here. Our heads will roll. This better look just as good as it always does. Again... Nothing's off limits to him. Nobody can tell him no. For 42, for all this effort, time, and expense, Solomon had no doubt created brilliant and spectacular achievements, which, as he has already told us, did not provide any lasting satisfaction. 43, how many people today spend their time seeking to create their own world within a world, pursuing aesthetic pleasures, building their homes, constructing their gardens as showcases for others to admire? And so, does that really make you happy when somebody comes by and says, ooh, that's really nice. That's pretty. Okay. You know what I find myself doing? You know, people show me stuff. You know, I'll see different things. You know, how's this? I'm like Chevy Chase at the Grand Canyon. Okay. I'll nod and say, yeah, that's nice. But I'm thinking, who cares? What difference does it make? I mean, there are some things that are just generally, again, seriously beautiful. And I appreciate beauty, and I would assume you do too. But does beauty satisfy? No. And if you're young, by the way, enjoy your beauty because it's going to fade. It's going to go. And you're going to get old, and you're going to die. And good news from Solomon. 44, what does it accomplish? What will they have at the end of their lives for all the time, energy, and money they've spent? And all the riches of the kings end up in wills. That's a line out of a song by Switchfoot. That's a Christian group that does, you know, contemporary music. But all the riches of the kings end up in wills. And as I was reading the lyrics of that song, I thought, man, they're quoting right out of Proverbs. They've read this book and they get it. You're going to leave it all to somebody else. And even when you get it just the way you want it, it is just so-so, and you like it, then you die. Then you die, and it's somebody else's. And who knows if they'll take care of it. They might not be inclined to take care of it. They might say, sell it. I've watched these people. I had a guy down here for years, the first 5 years I was here as pastor. Had a guy, lived in the biggest house, of course, had multiple cars that he had to store inside because they were classics, and all of that, and had them named. Named his cars. Do you name your car? Anybody here name their car? All right. He's got names for his cars. And all that. And what's going to happen to it when he dies? He's not on doctrine. His kids are going to get it, and they don't have any capacity for it, because I know both of them. They don't have any capacity for it. And they'll probably just sell it and pocket the money and move on. Oh, but man, we wax this car every week. We keep it inside. We keep a heater on it to keep it warm in the winter, air condition it in the summer. It's a car. It is a car. I like classic cars. They're okay, but it's a car. And at the end of it all, it's going to rust. Well, not if you keep it air conditioned and heated, I guess. keep it temperature controlled. This guy cared better for his cars than I cared for my wines. And during that time, I was lucky to be making $10,000 a year here. Go figure. Where's the priority? And where were Solomon's priorities, again, during this period in his life? Not on doctrine, that's for sure. Not on God or his plans. Well, here, now let's get into his other achievements, other accomplishments. I bought male and female slaves. I had homeborn slaves. I also possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. And again, he's not just talking about the kings. He's talking about anybody that's ever lived in Jerusalem from its most ancient history. Nobody could compete with me. I bought is actually the verb to buy, kana, Q-A-N-A-H. I start thinking and writing in Hebrew, and I have to get back to the right to left stuff, or left to right. I bought slaves is the word ebed, which is just exactly that, E-B-H-E-D-H. Slaves. Both here, you got the wow here, actually, which means both female. And you're going to follow it with another wow that means a male as well. And this word is shifka. And this word means S-H-I-P-H-C-H-A-H. Shifka, maids or female slaves. And I bought both male and sons. Male slaves, I'm sorry, Eved was the masculine plural noun. I bought male slaves and female slaves, is the idea. And I had homeborn slaves. And sons of the house, literally, is what you have in the Hebrew. Sons born in the house is the idea of it. You got the word ben, which means sons, and then the word bayi, which means house. B-A-Y-I-T-H. Again, slaves that were born of other slaves, essentially. Slaves, procreated. I had homeborn slaves, literally sons of the house became to me, is the literal Hebrew you've got here. You've got the cal perfect of hayah, the verb to become, to come into existence, to change a state. To become here has the idea of were born. Were born to me. See, I owned them from when they were born. They were mine. I didn't have to buy them, I owned them already. That was the beauty of having slaves in the house. When they procreated, they made more slaves for you. And after they got to, obviously they're not much use the first few years. but after a point, then they become slaves and they're productive and all that. So I had a slave, the sons of the house became to me, literally. Indeed, or also here, indeed, you got the particle gam, actually an adverb, I believe. Also, indeed, or even. Then you have this word here, mikneh, which is the general term for livestock, M-I-Q-N-E-H. The general term for livestock or herds. You basically divide herds into two types of animals, the larger ones like cattle and oxen, and that's what we see in the next word here, bakar, B-A-Q-A-R. And that word means cattle or oxen. It's indistinct. So it would encompass both. And then you have the word zone, T-S-O-N. Zone is smaller animals like sheep and goats. Still a part of the flocks, but obviously they're different in that regard. I possess flocks and herds. The idea is larger domesticated domesticated beasts and smaller ones that were used obviously for food and various other things, for their hides and all that. I also possess flocks and herds larger. You got the hiphil infinitive absolute here of rava, which means to cause, to be great, much, or many. They translate it by the term larger, cause to be more. So larger kind of communicates it. Became to me. Again, a cal perfect of hayah. Were mine is the idea of it. To me, again, how many times you see this prefix lamed here with the first singular suffix in these verses we've just been looking at? It's almost every other, practically every other word with Solomon. It's all about him. It's all about to me. It's I, me, mine. So they became to me. Became greater to me from all which had become before me, literally in Jerusalem, is sort of the literal Hebrew of it. And you have the preposition men, which is often used as a comparative. And especially they became greater than or larger than is the idea of it. That's what the men is translated, than. Then all, literally from all, literally coal, all, each, or every, in this context, all. And you got the prefix sheen here, the relative pronoun, which is actually just prefix to the word. All who or which is the translation of that relative pronoun there. All who had become, you got a cal perfect here looking to the historic past. All who had been before me is to my faces, literally, which means before. And it can be used in two ways, just as we use the term before. It can be used of time. In this case, he's talking about time. And it can also be used spatially, i.e. to my faces in front of me. But in this case, he's talking about time. All who came previous to me in Jerusalem, prefix bait, plus the word Yerushalayim. Also, if this isn't enough, I mean, God, how much do you need? He's encompassed with it, man. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold. All right. As a matter of fact, how much gold did he collect? Well, what we are told in the historic narrative was that he collected so much that silver became worthless. And again, silver's always been worth less than gold, but to be absolutely worthless? I mean, it was just like, silver became as valuable as water, as it were. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold. Again, they've added the word here also. It's really, actually, you do have the conjunction here, gam. But the idea here is they sort of supplied it, I think, the verse here. I collected is kanas.
K-A-N-A-S.
11 times this word used. It means to gather, to collect, or to assemble something. Prefix lamed plus the first, I can't believe it, another prefix lamed with another suffix. For myself, both, you got this word here, both. Silver is
kesef, K-E-S-E-P-H.
Silver and gold.
Zahav is the word for gold. Z-A-H-A-B-H.
Zahav, silver and gold. Even the treasure of kings and provinces. They've translated the wow here in sort of an ascensive way to point out that he's talking about the silver and gold, but I think he's going even beyond that. Also the treasure of kings might be better here, I think. Treasure here is segula,
S-E-G-H-U-L-L-A-H.
Eight times, this word just means possessions or personal property, the property of kings. So we're talking about royal bounty here. We're not just talking about, oh, I went out and collected some stuff. I got the best stuff kings had. I got the stuff from other kings that they had. I collected it for myself. Possessions are personal property of kings, and then you have this word, Medina.
M-E-D-H-I-Y-N-A-H.
And that word means an administrative district or a province. And so the idea here is whatever the best of the goods were in a particular region, Solomon got them. If it was a spice that was indigenous to that region they were famous for, he got it. If it was a particular animal, he got it. If it, whatever it might have been. If they were renowned for a gold, like Ophir was renowned for its gold. Apparently it was a very high quality of gold. More high quality than other places. Well, he got the gold from Ophir then. And so whatever it might have been in a particular region, didn't matter. Whatever they were known for, he got it. Also silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers. Again, I provided as a cow perfect of Asa here to make, to conscript, to buy. This gets into the way he got them. You know, he paid for them. So the idea here is I manufactured, again, prefix lamed, for myself. The cal active participle here in the masculine plural is shear. S-H-I-Y-R. The verb means to sing. So the participle here would be translated male singers. Male singers and wow. And then you've got the verb to sing again, shear, but in the feminine participle. Feminine plural. Male singers and female singers. So which do you like better? Do you like male singers or female singers? Well, doesn't matter. You don't have to pick. Solomon's got them both. Maybe some people have a preference. Male and female singers and the pleasures of men. And is wow here plus the masculine plural noun construct of ta anug, which is only used five times. T-A. And then you got an ayin, A-N-U-G-H, tanug. The root means that which is comfortable or luxurious or pleasurable or enjoyable. And so they've translated it, the pleasures of men. And literally the Hebrew has the pleasures of the sons of Adam. Again, sons of the man. So what is it that men like? Breasts. And that's exactly what the best we can do with this word here is it's a feminine singular noun and it's not attested outside of this passage. Shida. S-H-I-D-D-A-H. It appears to come from the root shad, which means the breast. And so literally what you would have is a feminine singular noun plus a wow plus the same noun repeated in the plural. A breast and breasts. Why did God create boobs, one might ask? For men. And so what does Solomon say? Well, you know, hey, if two are good, 2,000's better. And so he collected women just like he collected gold in that regard. And some women had a royal place in the court. I mean, they were recognized as official wives. And some women were simply there as what we might call concubines. They had no royal place. They were essentially slaves, sex slaves, we might say. Now, I'm sure they were well taken care of. I mean, look at where Solomon lives. Don't you think these women lived in the same place, pretty much? They lived in luxury just like he lived in luxury. And so some people might say, well, this would be great. If I could just have enough women, I'd be happy. One's enough, trust me. The idea here is that Solomon withheld himself from no pleasure. There wasn't anything that was off limits for him. He did what he wanted, and when he wanted, and where he wanted, and how long he wanted, and nobody stopped him. And he had all this freedom and all this power concentrated in one person. So that's the way life is sometimes. That's the way God operates. So he gives this guy all this power, all this freedom, all this money, all this time, and he gets to use it. And how does Solomon use it? Well, he uses it satisfying himself, which is what most men would do. I mean, if again, you had the idea that you had plenty of time, plenty of money, you could do whatever you want, believe me, you'd pamper yourself. I'm sure he went to the spa every day. Probably had massages anytime he wanted them. And, you know, anything he wanted, nothing, you know. Hey, I want to take a trip. He took a trip. I want to go here. He went there. Nothing stopped him. So he was the king. And God gives him all this power. And how does he use it? Well, hopefully, you know, the idea of any type of power is you want a benevolent dictatorship. But that's the nature of power. And God provided him all this, and all these blessings to go along with it. And he told him he would provide all these blessings because he didn't ask for them. He asked for wisdom. And so God honored him, and he gave him all this stuff. And even with the stuff he had, it wasn't enough. He went out and got more stuff. And so God gives him all this power, all this freedom, all this time, and how's he use it? Not wisely, we would say. Not particularly wisely. But did God take him down of being king? No, absolutely not. Do you think God was in favor of him having 1,000 women? I don't think so. I don't see anything in the text that tells me God's impressed with this. I see things that suggest that he was out of line. But you want to tell him? Hey, why don't you go in and straighten Solomon out? See how that works out for you. No, I'll pass. My head would be off. And so who's going to tell Solomon what to do? Nobody. Solomon's going to determine what he does. And we have no idea. I mean, a lot of people were put to slavery. We know that. The kingdom apparently was fairly prosperous, because when it says silver became worthless, that meant, I would assume, that a lot of people had gold at that point. That it wasn't just Solomon, that there was, we might call, the trickle-down effect. That as the kingdom became wealthy, and obviously Solomon spent a lot of it doing these projects and all that, well, he paid, I'm sure, he, you know, who when he didn't have slaves, he, you know, I'm sure he paid people. So many people probably became wealthy out of all of this. And some people would look at this and they would say, well, God, this is great. What's wrong with this system? Nothing. Solomon's wealthy. He's doing all this stuff. People are getting prospered. Must be good, right? Well, unfortunately, it's not good for Solomon. But yeah, okay, people have money, so what? If money made you happy, and that's what he's largely arguing here, I got all the silver and gold I want. I'm still not happy. I got all the women I want. I got all the treasure I want. I eat the finest exotic foods at all times. I've got spices that people can't even buy, can't even get. I live in a realm beyond what most people can even fathom. And I've got all the power and authority and time to do whatever I want. And so what did he get out of it? Well, as we're going to see, not much. Not anything lasting and satisfying. Well, point one, Koheleth continues to list his impressive accomplishments and acquisitions in verse 7, moving to the large number of slaves that he had at his disposal. Two, there are two types of slaves that are mentioned here, which include those that Koheleth obtained by purchase. And obviously, you know, the slave traders became rich off of him. He was buying them. And those that were born to slaves that were within his household. Two, the verb kana specifically refers to buying a commodity with money, which indicates that slaves were not viewed as anything other than another possession. And that is essentially what slavery is. You are the possession, you are the absolute possession of another person. You don't have any say-so. Your volition at that level doesn't matter. You're just to do what you're told. And you're there to serve your master, and that's it. It's not a democracy. The slaves didn't get together and vote and say, hey, we'd like better conditions. Off with his head. Anybody else want to vote? No? You'd only have to kill one slave to really make an example of them, wouldn't you? Yeah, you'd think that would make an example. Better get back to work. And so these are just things. Just detail, just another form of details, we might say. Only they're humans. They're human beings. Well, for no doubt Koheleth would only purchase the finest specimens that were available upon the slave market, both men and women. And I mean, he didn't just go out and arbitrarily buy slaves, I don't think. I think he looked for specific things he wanted. And no doubt, in some ways, simply for breeding stock, like you would cattle. So people say, well, this is callous, this is cruel. That's the way life was. You can comment on it all you want, but the fact is, it's just the nature of the beast at this point. And so people say, you know, they bemoan all this, the plight of the slave and all that. Oh, people are slaves today. Good grief. They're just slaves to different stuff. Slavery exists to the very end of time, as we saw in the passage there in Revelation 18, the Babylon passage. They're trading in the souls of men and women. So it exists. People can bemoan it. They can say this and that about it. The reality is the institution's not bad unless it's abused. I got to believe, personally, from what I see of Solomon here, I don't see anything that tells me he abused his slaves. I don't see anything that tells me that he was a horrible, god-awful master. I suspect his slaves may live better than you live. I mean, think of where they were living, for one thing. I'm sure the slave quarters weren't just, you know, mud huts thrown together. I imagine if Solomon bought a slave, he took care of him or her. And so they may live better than you and I live. You might have wanted to be a slave in Solomon's court. Who knows? Well, five, given the large nature of his property and holdings, Koheleth could easily justify the acquisition of many slaves, since such a large enterprise would require a lot of manpower to operate and maintain. I mean, he's got a big thing going on here. I mean, this is a big deal. Two, the second category of slave included those that were born to the slaves that Koheleth already owned. Seven, some have suggested that these slaves are to be limited only to the offspring that came when his servants procreated, whose children were automatically Koheleth's slaves. And Leupold points out, point eight, that these types of slaves were quite valuable and were prized for their inbred loyalty to the master. I mean, they're born in the master's house. From day one, they know nothing except the master. And so they, in some ways, might be a superior form of slave because of the loyalty factor. Whereas a purchased slave, you know, hey, you just bought me for money, so what? Well, nine, others have suggested that Solomon was not above using his female slaves for pleasure, indulging in sex whenever he wanted with women of his choice. I don't see anything in the text that proves that, but I don't see anything that would necessarily cause me to not believe it either. It seems that Solomon did whatever he wanted. That's the nature of power and authority. Yeah, power is simply the freedom to act. That's what authority is. It's the freedom to act. And so he has absolute authority in the kingdom. He has absolute power. He can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, again. So did he engage in sex? I wouldn't put it past him. So 10, any children produced from such a union would have become servants in his house, who might have occupied a higher position in the house, but were not considered princes. They would not have been considered royal heirs necessarily. To have that, you would have had to be a queen, recognized in a legal marriage to Solomon, and have a child through that union in order to be considered royalty. So 11, in any case, all this fits what we know about exceedingly rich and powerful people in the world. They always want someone else to perform menial tasks and do the hard work for them. And again, in all these projects we see, I don't think Solomon's out there digging ditches. I think his slaves are doing it. And but you got to run the household. You got laundry to do. You got floors to clean, this and that. Well, you got somebody else to do it. And isn't that nice, I guess? I mean, if you had a big enterprise like this, you'd have to have a lot of slaves to run it and to run it effectively. Well, 12, Solomon next turns to his other possessions, which would have been in the care of the slaves he owned, his herds and flocks. 13, the distinction here between herds and flocks is that herds would include the larger farm animals like cattle and oxen, while flocks would include the smaller livestock like sheep and goats. 14, like having servants, possessing herds and flocks was indicative of those that were wealthy, since such animals may multiply quickly and increase one's net worth. That would be a good question. What was Solomon's net worth at his zenith? I think it would be almost incalculable. I mean, it is a huge number. It's bigger than Bill Gates, I can tell you that. And he's pretty wealthy and well off. But I think Solomon would have swamped him in what he had. So 14, again, this is indicative of those that are wealthy. 15, in any case, his extensive land holdings, building projects, large slave holdings, and huge flocks would only serve to document his great wealth. Anybody that looked at this would just say, "Man, this guy is rich beyond belief." I mean, it's incredible what he's got. So 16, to emphasize this point, Koheleth compares his unrivaled holdings to all those that had lived in Jerusalem before him, just as he had compared his wisdom and knowledge in chapter 1. And this leads me to believe that Jerusalem was recognized as something during that time, that this was a big deal. This was a big city. This was viewed as something quite important. Whereas, you know, today maybe people don't recognize Jerusalem as what it is. But the fact that he keeps emphasizing Jerusalem, to me indicates that there was, number one, a lengthy history of a wisdom tradition there. And number two, apparently there was a lengthy history of wealth there that, you know, people may not allude to, but it certainly appears that from the fact that he would cite this suggests to me that these things mattered. Well, 17, Koheleth concludes the description of his earthly prosperity by listing three final things that surely have appealed to men over the course of human history. 18, the first item in verse 8 concludes the section about his possessions and wealth, focusing on the actual liquid financial resources that were readily available to him. 19, according to the historical narrative, Solomon had so much silver at his disposal that it became a very common commodity in Jerusalem. 2 Chronicles 9:27 is the verse that documents that. And so essentially, silver became like our pennies, we might say. Do you worry about your pennies? Do you keep them? If you see a penny, do you stop and pick it up? Oh, there's a penny. Well, that's because it's not considered valuable. 2 Chronicles, rather, 9:27. The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem. Oh, better yet, not even our pennies. That's just, you want to pick up a rock? No. And he made cedars as plentiful as sycamore trees that are in the lowland. Apparently, cedar was quite a valuable commodity in that day. It was considered a big deal. Obviously, for its aromatic qualities and all that. And apparently Solomon liked it because, as we saw in his house, he used a lot of cedar. And I suspect there were reasons for that. But actually, and if you want to back up here, let's start at verse 22. So King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And all the kings of the earth were seeking the presence. Again, you talk about celebrity, he is it. There is no TV. There is no mail, as it were. There is no mass communication, and yet his wealth and his fame has spread all over the planet. I mean, he is the topic of the day. Have you heard about Solomon? No, who's that? It's the king in Jerusalem. I mean, you're not going to believe. You're not going to believe what this guy's done, what he's got. It's unbelievable. And as the Queen of Sheba told him, you know, I heard it, but they didn't even tell me the half of it. I mean, I can't believe what I'm seeing here, the way you've got all this. And all the kings were coming to hear his wisdom, which God put in his hearts. And they brought every man his gift, articles of silver, gold, garments, weapons, spices, horses, and mules. So much year by year. And now Solomon had 4,000 stalls for his horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And he stationed them in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. He was ruler over all the kings from the Euphrates River, even to the land of the Philistines. That's down in Gaza there in the southern, southwestern part of Israel, by the Mediterranean. And he made cedars, the king made silver as common as stones. And they were bringing horses for Solomon from Egypt and all the countries. And again, if you've got a map in your Bible, if you've got a Bible map, you look at the Mediterranean and see where it's at. And see where the Euphrates is, and look at the region of the land that he ruled over. I mean, it was huge. And they were absolutely subservient to him. I mean, that is quite a big piece of land that he's in charge of. And again, he had no enemies that we know about, that God raised up some as discipline in the latter part of his life. But for the largest part of his reign, it was peaceful. And again, his name sort of prefigured that. Comes from the root shalom, for peace. He ruled over, again, just a huge area. The kingdom was at its zenith. It never was any bigger than this. And he had everything he wanted. There wasn't anything he couldn't do, any place he couldn't go, anything he couldn't have. It was all his for the taking. Well, 20 of the biblical accounts of Solomon's reign indicate that gold was also very plentiful in his kingdom. Solomon possessed a bank account that would be the absolute envy of anyone that's ever lived. Bill Gates would kill to have his bank account. And I think he's doing pretty well last time I checked. 21, the historical narrative indicates that Solomon received 666 talents of gold in a given year, which does not appear to be recorded as an unusual fact. 1 Kings 10:14. I mean, it's sort of, in the narrative, I mean, it's just sort of alluded to, like, okay, well, this is what happened. This is not unusual. Well, Solomon's, this happens, and so. 1 Kings 10:14. Now the weight of gold which came to King Solomon in one year was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, from the traders and the wares of the merchants and all the kings of the Arabs and the governors of the country. And Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold. Solid one-piece shields of gold. Using 60 shekels of gold on each large shield. He made 300 shields of beaten gold using 3 minas of gold on each shield. And the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. And by the way, when he said he built houses, we don't know how many he built. We can't really even tell you. But we know of 2 major ones that he built. But my suspicion is he may have had a dozen houses. We don't know. And the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with refined gold. There were 6 steps to the top of the throne, and the round top to the throne at its rear, and its arms on the side of the seat, and 2 lions standing beside the arms. 12 lions were standing on the 6 steps on the one side and on the other. Nothing like it was made for any other kingdom. This is just beyond the pale of anything. I mean, you can't even, if you saw it, you'd probably, again, you'd just be standing there aghast. Just how can this be? Well, given the fact, point 22, that a talent ranged from 70 to 90 pounds, and using today's prices, this would indicate that the value of the gold brought into the kingdom of the during a single year, this is just 1 year out of his 40-year reign, by the way, was somewhere between $500 million and $650 million. And that's just a year. And that's not including the silver, the other values of the things he has. We're just talking about the gold. Now, how could you live on that as a yearly salary? You think? $500 million? I'll try it. I'll be willing to experiment. And again, that's just the gold. That doesn't include all the other stuff. This is just astronomical. This is unbelievable. To have this kind of money. And it's flowing into the kingdom. I mean, he's not going out and pursuing this. It's just coming to him. 23, in fact, again, gold was so valuable that during the reign it actually devalued the lesser precious metals like silver, as we saw there. It's also a parallel passage in 1 Kings 10:21 there. All his drinking vessels were gold, verse 21, and all the vessels of the house to the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None was of silver. Can't have silver in the house. I mean, that would just cheapen the place. How many people would love to have sterling silver utensils for everything they had? Oh, people would die for that. Sterling silver is considered, big deal. Not in Solomon's kingdom. Nope, it all had to be gold. Well, 24, the next reference to the treasures of kings and provinces is introduced by a wow that is to be understood in the sense of addition. Silver and gold were the treasures that belonged to kings. I mean, those were as a genitive of possession, we might say, which were brought to Solomon as tribute. However, point 26, the term likely went beyond the simple matter of valuable metals to encompass the personal property that would be possessed by those in royal houses. 2 Chronicles 9, 23 and 24. So, pretend you're royalty. You live in a palace, you're a king or a queen. How are you going to outfit your house? You going to have fine tapestries and weavings and all of that? Or are you going to have a picture of dogs playing poker? What are you going to have? You're going to have, you know, expensive artwork. You're going to have expensive details to accessorize and everything. You're going to have, you know, the couch in Fraser that his dad sat on? Or are you going to have, you know, the recliner? Or are you going to have the finest Corinthian leather? What are you going to have? Well, you're going to have the best and the highest that you can have. That's what all kings would do. That's what they would do. And Solomon says, look, I got all these kings that bring me this stuff. And they just give it to me. 2 Chronicles 9, 23 and 24. And again, we just read this. They all brought their gifts, articles of silver, gold, garments. Hey, what kind of clothes are you going to have? You going to wear just cutoffs and blue jeans? Or are you going to wear really nice stuff? You know, expensive tailored suits. Maybe expensive tailored robes. You know, you got your own personal tailor, you know that. He's going to, you know, are you going to wear just a, you know, a sweater from Target? Or are you going to get cashmere? What are you going to have? Solomon would not have been shopping at Target or Kmart. Actually, Solomon probably wouldn't have been shopping at Home Depot even. Solomon would have been going for the highest and the best, and they brought him the highest and the best. And you didn't come up showing up at a kingdom with somebody as great as Solomon with some chintzy gift. Here, what'd you get? I brought you a rock. Off of his head. He probably wouldn't have killed the king, but no king would have done that. Royalty has a certain sense about it, of how to conduct oneself and all that. And so they brought the highest and the best, the greatest in clothing. And for some people, that's a big deal. I have found that, you know, nice clothing beats bad clothing. I mean, that's been my assessment over the years. But, God, do you need a $1,000 suit? You know, they got them at K&G for $200 for $300. So, hey, the highest and the best, really. And spices, you know, how much does, what's that real expensive spice, saffron? Come, you know, they got to pick up like one little strand at a time. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that he would have had saffron running out his ears. And again, when they brought horses and mules, you know, they're bringing Kentucky Derby champions. They're not old beat up mule coming, you know, no. And they're probably not just bringing one or two. They're bringing herds to add to Solomon's already extensive holdings. Again, it's mind-boggling to me to even try to consider what all this guy had and how he would have lived. Again, silk robes or polyester? Do you think Solomon wore polyester leisure suits? No, not at all. So again, when they brought these things in, they were high quality. They were top notch. And look at how God blesses this guy. You know, one of the things that took me as a while as a believer to get over was this idea that God didn't want to bless me. Why would God bless me? What's the point? What's God got in it? You know, what's he get out of blessing me? And you kind of have to get over the idea that, look, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. Well, who is worthy? Is Solomon more righteous than I am? Is he a different man? Does he not put his pants on one leg at a time just like everybody else does? Didn't he have an STA? Didn't he sin? So why does God choose to bless one and not bless another? You know, for years I struggled with, you know, I don't need anything. I don't want anything. I expect God to bless me. That's a stupid attitude to have. I realize that. Stupid attitude to have. If God wants to bless me with something, I'm happy to have it now. I can enjoy it and have capacity for it. And guess what? Yeah, and God honors it. Now, if you're patient and wait and all that, I think God honors that. But this idea that God wouldn't bless me or shouldn't or why would he, well, that's nonsense. There's no reason for God to bless anybody then. We're all sinners. We all fail. We all fall short. The issue is positive volition. And see, this gets back to another whole issue of volition too. Why does God bless certain people and jam others? And it's volition. It's not just what they do. Everybody sins. But why does he frustrate some people and jam them up? Because of their volition. They're negative at a certain point. Or they've gone negative or they've done this or that. And they end up frustrated and miserable. And you don't have to live that way. I seriously wonder if people recognize the difference between positive and negative volition anymore. And it's not a matter of do you sin or do you fail. Everybody does that. Do you want the truth? Do you really want to do it God's way? Or are you just insistent on doing it your own way? Huh? If you're willing to do it God's way and you're really serious about it and you'll humble yourself under God's hand, there's no telling what he might do for you. I wouldn't hold anything back from him. He certainly blessed Solomon big time. And again, I don't think it's because of Solomon's personal righteousness or this or that. He blessed him because Solomon pursued wisdom first. Solomon recognized the value of knowing God's plan and doing it. And that's what he prayed for. He didn't pray for the death of his enemies and all that. The things he could have prayed for. So again, the idea here, he was the beneficiary of a lot of stuff. Well, you got to have people to take care of that stuff. Get me some more slaves. So as the Bible makes plain here, he was the beneficiary of things that were not limited to the financial realm. That's the 1 Kings 10:10 passage, which I believe we have looked at. And the reference to provinces here, point 28, indicates that Solomon was not only the beneficiary of gifts from others in positions of royalty. He was honored by those that might occupy lesser positions. 2 Chronicles 9:13, there we see the weight of the talent and all that came to him, 13 and 14. And besides that which the traders and merchants brought. Now see, there's also the businessmen out there that say, I want to go see Solomon. And if I'm going to show up at Solomon's place, I better bring something. And so they brought the best of their wares, whatever it might have been, whatever they specialized in. You know, merchants specialize in different things. And all the kings of Arabia and the governors of the country brought silver and gold to Solomon. So it wasn't just, we might say, the royal houses that did, but even their subservient rulers that were in positions of power that had been delegated their authority for whatever reason. Well, they honored him as well. And again, verse 21, for the king had ships. And besides all this, now Solomon has this friend, Hiram, which was a wise thing for him. It was a friend of David's, his dad. And he stuck with him. For the king had ships which went to Tarshish with the servants of Huram. Once every 3 years, the ships of Tarshish came bringing gold and silver, ivory and apes and peacocks. So I bet Solomon had an extensive zoo there too. Again, he had this whole idea of forests and gardens and parks and all. Also, again, served as animal preserves where they could live in their wild, as it were, rather than all caged up. So the idea here is that he's the beneficiary of a lot of things, and God's blessed him beyond belief. And but at a certain level, he finds it all a little bit dissatisfying. Why? Well, because I think it's because of his orientation, not God's. God obviously is not wrong in any of this. It's Solomon's orientation. Solomon's, at a certain point, he changes his mind about things. He begins doing really stupid stuff. He can pay the price for it. It's going to take a toll on him, whether he knows it or not. All right, well, our time's up, so let's stop there, and we will continue on here Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying these things. May God the Holy Spirit impress upon us the futility of pursuing things in life and the absolute wisdom of pursuing Bible doctrine and allowing you to bless us according to your will. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.